You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
We are a better species for having fought this war. Cormac Bright Boy Wallace. 20 minutes after the war ends, I'm watching stumpers pour up out of a frozen hole in the ground like ants from hell and praying that I keep my natural legs for another day. Each walnut-sized robot is lost in the mix as they climb over each other and the whole nightmare jumble of legs and antennae blend together into one seething, murderous mass. With numb fingers, I fumble my goggles down over my eyes and get ready to do some business with my little friend Rob here. It's an oddly quiet morning. Just the sigh of the wind through stark tree branches and the hoarse whisper of 100,000 explosive mechanical hexapods searching for human victims. Up above, snow geese honk to each other as they glide over the frigid Alaskan landscape. The war is over. It's time to see what we can find. From where I'm standing, 10 yards away from the hole, the killer machines look almost beautiful in the dawn, like candy spilled out onto the permafrost. I squint into the sunlight, my breath billowing out in pale puffs, and sling my battered old flamethrower off my shoulder. With one gloved thumb, I depress the ignite button. Spark. The thrower doesn't light. Needs to warm up, so to speak, but they're getting closer. No sweat. I've done this dozens of times. The trick is to be calm and methodical, just like them. Rob must have rubbed off on me after the first couple years. Spark. Now I see the individual stumpers, a tangle of barbed legs attached to a bifurcated shell. I know from experience that each side of the shell contains a different fluid. The texture and heat of human skin initiates a trigger state. The fluids combine. Pop! Somebody wins a brand new stump. Spark. They don't know I'm here, but the scouts are spreading out in semi-random patterns based on Big Rob's study of foraging ants. The robots learn so much about us, about nature. It won't be long now. Spark. I begin to back away slowly. Come on, you bastard, I mutter. Spark. That was a mistake to talk. The heat from my breath is like a beacon. The flood of horror surges my way, quiet and fast. Spark. A lead stumper climbs onto my foot. Gotta be careful now. Can't react. If it pops, I'm minus a foot, best case. I should never have come here alone. Spark. Now the flood is at my feet. I feel a tug on my frost-covered shin guard as the leader climbs me like a mountain. Metal filament antenna tap, tap, tap along, questing for the telltale heat of human flesh. Spark. Oh, Christ. Come on, come on, come on. Spark. There's going to be a temperature differential at my waist level, where the armor chinks. A torso-level trigger state and body armor isn't a death sentence, but it doesn't look good for my balls either. Spark. Whoomph. I'm lit. A jet of flame leaps from my thrower. Its heat blooms on my face and sweat evaporates off my cheeks. My peripheral vision narrows. All I see are the controlled spurts of fire I'm arcing out onto the tundra. Sticky, burning jelly coats the river of death. The stumpers sizzle and melt by the thousands. I hear a chorus of high-pitched whines as the chilled air trapped in their carapaces squeezes out. No explosions, just the occasional sputtering flare. The heat boils the juice in their shells before detonation. The worst part is that they don't even care. They're too simple to understand what's happening to them. They love the heat. I start to breathe again when the leader drops off my thigh and scurries toward the flames. The urge to step on the little mother is strong. But I've seen the boots fly before. Early on in the new war, the hollow backfire of a trigger state stumper and the confused hopping screams that came afterwards were as common as gunfire. All the soldiers say that Rob likes to party, and when he gets going, he's one hell of a dance partner. The last of the stumpers suicidally retreat toward the smoking lump of heat and the sizzling corpses of their comrades. I dig out my radio. Bright Boy to base. Shaft 511. Booby trap. The little box squawks at me with an Italian accent. Copy, Bright Boy. This is Leo. Come in. Get your ass to shaft 512. Holy shit. We got something for real here, boss. I crunch over the frost back to shaft 512 to see for myself how real it is.
Daniel Wilson is the author of books that include How to Survive a Robot Uprising, Tips on Defending Yourself Against the Upcoming Rebellion, Where's My Jetpack? A Guide to the Amazing Science Fiction fiction future that never arrived, How to Build a Robot Army, Mad Scientist Hall of Fame, and Brojitsu. His new book is Robopocalypse. Thank you for joining me, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, this book is a wonderfully written, beautifully crafted piece of terror that is completely page-turning, but I think you do a great job at evoking a kind of nostalgic feel for the world that we currently live in. You make us appreciate what we have right now so much by so effectively tearing it apart.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I tried to ground the book in a really relatable place. You know, I mean, it's called Robopocalypse. It's pretty clear what's going to happen. Just reading and or trying to pronounce the title. You know, I didn't want to just have robot armies come out from outer space. Instead, it's really our cell phones, our automobiles, very near future types of technologies that are kind of turning on humankind.
You know, when I was thinking about this novel this morning, one of your themes is that technology, our own technology, is turned against us. And I thought, this is kind of the natural follow-on of what happened to us in 9/11.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, you do realize that when you have a large, complicated network that's supporting civilization, you know, we have all these things, all these technologies that are happening at once. You've got all your utilities, your transportation, your communication. And then you think, you know, what if some of that started going wrong? And then what if all of it went wrong? And yeah, and airplanes are falling out of the sky and cars are wrecking themselves. It's just that, you know, we depend on technology, and I think that's a great thing. I think that, you know, we are where we are because of our technology, but it's also really frightening to really think about how much you depend on it and to contemplate what might happen, you know, if it not only went wrong, but if it decided it didn't like us.
Now, one of the things you do is to ground this in a world that seems very familiar to us. You've really got a great Day After Tomorrow feel to this novel. There's a lot of really interesting technological developments that you posited, and they're very slight and subtle, but I want to talk just about the feel that you create of this Day After Tomorrow. Like I said, there's a kind of like a nostalgia. Although the book begins, things go immediately awry.
Well, there's a lot of foreplay, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the
exactly.
Book doesn't start with 0 hour. You know, starts. You know, the whole first fifth of the book is in the year before the real, you know, robot uprising happens, before the robopocalypse. And so there's all these signs of things that are going wrong, and there's a few people that are starting to notice. You know, things aren't the way they ought to be. And then, of course, it hits like a tidal wave.
Well, one of the things you do is create a gallery of great characters, and it has a global kind of span to it. There's people everywhere. And I like the feel that when we're reading characters, you kind of think, well, these are people are sort of nobodies in a sense. But you know also as a reader that they're going to be very important. You do a great job of kind of keeping that balance for us.
Yeah, the conceit of the book is that these are all these people played some role in defeating the machines. And the reason that we know their stories is because the machine, in the moments before the final battle, has gone back through and figured out exactly how this happened. How did these humans end up at my doorstep? And it's also not, you know, it seems like I give it away at the beginning, but by the time you get to the end, I think you realize that's not so clear cut. For me, this was really a great way to write the book, because every time I was writing a chapter, I knew why is this an important chapter? How did this end up being a seminal moment that contributed toward the ultimate, you know, battle between humans and the big bad robot? And so that made it a lot easier for me. And it also allowed me to jump to just the juicy bits, you know? So I just got to write my favorite parts. And you know, being able to have such a big cast of characters was also great, because they've all got, not only are they all very different, there's, you know, men and women, old people, young people, people from the city, people from the country. You know, I go to Japan and Afghanistan and, of course, the United States. It actually allowed me, they've all got different viewpoints on technology as well. You know, some of them love technology, really, really love it. others don't care about it at all. You know, other people are technically knowledgeable about it, but don't really think of it beyond that. So, you know, I had a great time being able to explore all those different viewpoints.
You know, this is something that strikes me, too, that you've got from your previous books where you looked at how we look at technology, and you've just kind of taken that kaleidoscope and turned it into characters. And it must have been fun for you to create you have a variety of prose voices in this book, and it must have been fun for you to create them and their perspectives.
Well, I grew up in Oklahoma, and a lot of the book takes place in Oklahoma, with members of the Osage Nation and Cherokee. And so I'm a little bit Cherokee, like everybody in Oklahoma. And I grew up in the Cherokee Nation, you know, registered to vote and everything. And so, you know, the voices out there, those are pretty easy because those are all just ingrained in me from growing up, you know. And then, but some of them were more difficult. Luckily, going to grad school, you end up really interacting with people from all over the place. And so, you know, I had a good, in fact, in the master's degree program that I entered, I was, for a year, I was the only American. And there were people from everywhere, you know, and you sort of get used to, you're around these people all the time, day and night. And so you do get, you know, you get used to those voices. And so luckily I was able to kind of draw on some of those voices. But also I was really lucky to have good friends who, you know, my friend Tim Horniak lives in Japan, and I made him vet, or I asked him to vet all the Japanese stuff so that I got it right and the voice was right and the cultural stuff was right. And then I find out later that he actually writes, I'm going to get it wrong, but he's the guy who writes the guidebooks, you know, to visiting Tokyo. Like, because, you know, the guidebook companies hire people to do each city, you know, so that's... So he's the perfect person. And of course, my English friends read the English bits to make sure I had all my slang correct. And so, you know, that was really fun. And it's also really crucial to make sure you get those voices consistent so that you don't confuse people as you jump, you know, one minute you're in Afghanistan with soldiers and the next minute, you know, you're in rural Pennsylvania or something. So,
well, it's really fun to read. And I agree with you. This is a book of only good bits.
Yeah,
that's rock and fun.
Yeah, none of the boring stuff. There's nothing boring in there because of the way the book is set up. I just skip as soon as, you know, whatever the big event is, as soon as it's over, I just skip to the next big event because it's really just a series of these links in a big chain that lead to this final battle.
And a nice layering of plot, too. And I love the way these chapters are constructed with quotes at the beginning, introductions to the characters, and then at the end, you always give us these kind of tantalizing hints as to what's going to happen. And in lesser talented hands, I think that might be a problem, but the way you spin it out is really fun. And it also, as I say, it lends the whole enterprise a certain kind of poignancy looking back on this world that is gone. And we know that there are survivors out there, and that's the real pull of the book is we don't know. We know that something happened. We know it looks like there are human survivors, but we don't know what they're looking back from.
That was, you know, being vague was crucial because this is such an epic scope, and there's no way for me to really figure out, you know, in incredible detail what would happen in every single place. And so the best way to do it is to leave it up to the reader's imagination. And, you know, I had just watched District 9 whenever I was writing this. And one thing I loved about District 9 is they just don't explain anything. And I was thinking a lot about that a lot. And that happens in a lot of fiction, you know. And I realized just how much I loved, I found myself musing about District 9 and thinking, you know, why are there weapons? Why do they have weapons? What kind of battles have they been fighting in space? You know, and they never even get close to talking about that. And, you know, I have to say a confession, my absolute favorite little detail with that opens huge doors in all of Robopocalypse is at the end, you know, you spent this whole book, all these people have figured out, you know, they've basically been attacked and they've been decimated. They figured out where the bad guy is at. You know, they're closing in on the bad guy. And when they get to the final battlefield in this frigid landscape, very human, not very friendly to humans, they find thousands of dead Eastern European and Asian soldiers. And you realize this whole thing has already happened in Eastern Europe, and they've already found out where the bad guy was, and they've already mounted a huge attack, and they've somehow failed. And that's all, it's one paragraph in the whole book. And I love it. I love that it, suddenly you just realize, oh my God, you know, we're really just following one small group of people, and it's this huge, you know, world that's being affected with millions and billions of people, and we're not going to hear all their stories, but we're going to get hints.
You know, actually, I just read that paragraph again about 15 minutes ago. Now, one of the things that's great about this book, I think it's truly an epic horror novel in its sense. It has a science fiction feel, and you know, it's very realistic, and your grasp of technology is superb in the way it plays out in terms of extrapolation uses science fiction. But it is absolutely one of the most frightening books I've read in a long time.
Well, and I think that's because 99% of my focus was on the characters. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I spent very little time talking about technical robot details. You know, mm-hmm. that really doesn't appear in the book. I mean, it's all really through the character's perspective. So I have all this background in robotics and technology, and of course I would love to describe every detail of all these robots because I did so much thinking about how they would all work, but instead I just had to show it through those characters' eyes, and if they knew a little bit about technology, then they might be able to work out, you know, how these robots are working and why they're behaving the way they are. But really my job was behind the scenes to make sure that all the robots behaved totally consistently so that it was very believable. And you never had a moment where you just go, oh, well, you know, that could never happen, you know. So I spent a lot of time trying to make sure of that. But I think if it's scary, then the reason is because you're really with the characters, you know. And it's not scary because the robots are huge or because, you know, it's scary because you really care about this person who's maybe about to have their life ended in a really horrific way. You're just thinking, and there were some characters I couldn't bear to hurt. Mm. Ones I, and then there's one character I feel really bad about killing, actually, but I won't mention.
No, don't. We want to find that out as we read it. This begins. One of the things that's nice about this is it begins really quickly. I mean, immediately. After the stumpers that we see, which kind of gets us a post game wrap up in a sense, once we get into it, it begins very subtly and very quickly with a man who's working on an AI. And I really like the way what you said is very true. We have the sense, though, we never get any kind of techno jargon, techno babble, no kind of, Dr. Science moments. No info dumps in this book.
Well, this is the scientist has basically created an incredibly intelligent artificial intelligence, and it's also incredibly manipulative. So the first time when he's speaking to it, it has looked through a webcam and seen his office where he's speaking from and seen an image of his son and speaks to him as his own son in order to better manipulate him. So it's very human, you know. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, but continue, sorry.
Well, no, that's what I like about it is that you've created such a fine superstructure that we never doubt what's happening. You don't have to stop and explain anything. We absolutely believe it. And but I like this idea. And tell us, but there's something, one kind of detail I do want to ask about. Mm-hmm. What exactly is a Faraday cage?
So a Faraday cage is just a metal box that's grounded someplace. And all it does is it blocks all electromagnetic, it blocks radio, and it blocks, sort of any signals that are traveling over the air. You know, they haven't really appeared much in film. There's one, Gene Hackman is inside of one, I think, in a movie called Enemy of the State. Mm-hmm. But basically nothing gets in, nothing gets out. It all gets caught in the cage and gets grounded someplace. And so it's a great place to be if there's, it's a great place to put your equipment if there's an EMP attack, an electromagnetic pulse, because it'll just generate a current in the cage and it'll go nowhere instead of doing that inside of your electronics. But it's just basically, a way to protect your equipment from radio waves. And also, it's a way to trap what's inside and to keep anything from getting out.
It's an electronic jail.
Yeah, basically.
Which doesn't work so well. Now,
Well, it works. I mean, it functions. It's just that the machine finds, the machine is too clever.
That's the problem with building something too clever.
Well, yeah, and speaking of that, it's quite a challenge to write a character who essentially has godlike intelligence, is omniscient, mm-hmm. and is just really smart. It's like trying to write Hannibal Lecter or something. This is a person that, this is a machine in my case. That's just, its capabilities are so far beyond all the other characters in the book and the reader and me, the author. So, again, mysteriousness goes a long way.
Well, that goes to the Lovecraft quote, because that was Lovecraft's fictional technique was to give you, say, there's something out there. It's cyclopean. It's immense. We cannot even conceive of how horrible it is. Then he'd show you a tentacle or something.
Or he would come up with one super creepy, line of a poem that was found scribbled on a piece of paper in a dead man's hand and ripped from the Necronomicon, and then you suddenly are, completely certain. People are wondering, wait, now is this Necronomicon real? Because, you just have to show people a glimpse, and their minds will fill in all the rest. And I know that because I love Lovecraft. I love it whenever that happens to me, mm-hmm. And I'm reading, and suddenly I'm mentally creating all this extra, all these extra things.
Well, you're a master of it yourself, because there is a doll in here that there's a number of moments that in here where we see things that happen. The buildup, the precursor virus, as mm-hmm. this, what you call the precursor virus, right, spreads. And so I'd like you to talk about architecting this as a writer. Did you do this on a spreadsheet or on like a schedule kind of thing?
This is an Excel spreadsheet. Yeah,
really.
I have it all marked out. It was my original proposal. I wrote 100 pages of this, and then I had an annotated table of contents detailing the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. And so after I sold it, I had to go and write the rest of it. And over the course of editing it with my editor Jason Kaufman at Doubleday, I had to throw away a lot of stuff and simplify it, because it was taking too long for the people to mesh up, mm-hmm. and the expectation was that the readers would finally say, all right, enough of this. Like, how do these people know each other? Like, what's going to happen? Get to it, Wilson, So I really had to cut a lot and get it all crammed together.
Delete column.
Yeah. And I had some pretty cool characters that had to go, which is unfortunate, but a necessary evil.
Well, one of the things that's, I think, really enjoyable here, and we talked a little bit about this, is the multicultural, multinational setting of this. Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's a little bit reminiscent of World War Z. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to talk about, particularly about creating Takeo Nomura. He's such a great character, and we really like him.
Yeah, Takeo is... is definitely, so he's a Japanese, he's an elderly Japanese man, and he works in a factory, and he lives with a love doll that's not a sexual thing. The doll doesn't even have those kinds of parts, but he's really in love with her, and I leave this also up in the air, she resembles a real person, and so you kind of think that maybe this guy lost his wife at some point, and now he's living with this, sort of animate doll that reminds him of his wife. And his relationship with technology is that he really respects it, and he respects pretty much all inanimate objects as living creatures. And so there have been lots of books written on why the Japanese have a different outlook toward technology, and in particular robots, than Americans. And one small slice of that pie, I think it's a complicated question, is the notion of, Shintoism and Buddhism, with this fundamental idea that inanimate objects have some kind of living spirit inside. Not everybody's Buddhist in Japan, but it is a sort of a common undercurrent to the culture, just like everybody's not, Christian in the United States, but, people know who Adam and Eve are and things like that. There are these undercurrents. So I think that Takeo, he sees his love doll, even though she's inanimate, as having sort of a living spirit inside. And so when she becomes sentient, it's not such a big leap for him. You know, he already respects these things as living creatures. And so he's the only one that actually sees this whole robopocalypse as a disease that's infecting the minds of, the true minds of all these inanimate objects. And he wants to cure them, you know.
And that proves to be helpful. Now, one of the things that's so remarkable is that you posit this world where a lot of technology is so commonplace that characters don't really have to think about it. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes the book so powerful, because we don't have to think about now, as in a way that we don't think too much about TVs and cell phones and whatever. These people don't think about domestic robots and cars that drive themselves. So I'd like you to talk about I think you must have done a huge amount of background work to architect the place where this novel fires off from.
Well, yeah, I needed to have a consistent range of technology that was around, mm-hmm. and yet have it be near future stuff. And so, you know, you might have noticed a few days ago there was an article that Google is quietly lobbying the Nevada government to pass a law to make driverless cars legal on mm-hmm. the road. And they're not doing that because they don't have driverless cars. You know, they're not lobbying, you know, public officials, you know, without the technology to back it up. So, you know, this is stuff that we already have. And in fact, you know, I spent a lot of time, I've been asked a few times, what about as technology advances, is Robopocalypse going to get left behind? Is it going to look silly? And in fact, I ignored almost all the really complex, far out robotics technology because I wanted to keep it near future and believable. And so, you know, there are driverless cars, and there's Asimo, and there are domestic robots. None of these things have gotten into the hands of regular people, but they're poised to. And so those are really the range of technologies that I focused on. And also I love how people focus so much on the next big gizmo. Mm-hmm. And then the instant that it's here, it becomes so mundane as to never warrant any mentioning. Or it's something that you just complain bitterly about for whatever it doesn't do right. You know, one minute it's the Holy Grail. The next minute it's just a piece of junk, you know, and you're looking at the next Holy Grail. And so, you know, these people are the same way. So I for instance, really enjoyed writing Laura Perez. She realizes that something's wrong with the technology, and so she goes and finds the oldest, crummiest car that she can find. It doesn't have, anything. It's an old classic car, so it's completely mechanical. And she's driving it, and she hates it. She's just thinking, how could people do this? It's like if you get on a horse and you realize, yeah, you ride on a horse for a little while and it hurts your butt. How did people used to do that? You know, how did they ride these every day? And she's in this car and she hates it. And that's how people are. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I think this novel really does well, is to bring up this whole brew of our perceptions of technologies, good and bad. As you say, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, cell phones were a miracle. Now they're an annoyance, and especially when somebody else is using them,
or if they don't work immediately, you know, instantly. Yeah, and I'm the most bitter complainer.
Oh man, I just hate that technology. It's not ready, I think, yet. It still doesn't. Half the time, you still can't hear people, and it mm-hmm. doesn't go from cell. We'll stop there. But so talk about just you yourself are a roboticist. You're immersed in the latest. You know it all. You've invented some of it. So talk about immersing yourself in all these different viewpoints. And because you have some great stuff from the Osage Nation.
Yeah. Well, you know, so you different people all are going to have different, you know, approaches to technology and how they feel about it. And in your own life, I mean, you can mentally sort of go through. Your grandma has a different sort of feeling about technology than, you know, your young nephew or something, or your kids. So, you know, first thing I had to do was go through all the real technology. And luckily, having written for Popular Mechanics and done some journalism, I had all of that stuff handy, you know. and of course, going to school, you know, I had all those people on my Rolodex. I could call them up and say, how's the driverless car going, you know, and figure out, where all this stuff was really at. But then in terms of just people's individuals, you know, perspective on this, that was really just from me thinking about, you know, people I knew and are in my life, and also interviewing people. So, you know, I interviewed Native Americans and just, you know, I interviewed lots of people.
You know, you have a great vision of war in the near future, particularly Afghanistan. Tell us about the SAPs.
Sure. So I love a reversal, you know. Mm-hmm. I love it whenever you expect one thing and then it's the opposite, and then there's a good reason for it, and it's not just shock value. And one thing that, you know, I've ended up thinking about a lot is obviously robotics and how they're used in warfare. And one sort of personal peeve that I have is how often in fiction war robots look like people. And we're just not that good of a platform for fighting. I mean, you don't make an airplane flap its wings, right? You have your own, there's a way of doing things, you know? So, and you don't have to ape humankind constantly. And so the SAPs stand for Safety and Pacification Units, and they're humanoid. And the only reason I think to have a humanoid platform in a war zone is to take advantage of what the human form gives you, which is the ability to communicate with other human beings. And so Sappy is one of these guys. And what it does is it just patrols the streets as sort of a policeman, you know, and it won't engage in any violence, and it simply records people's faces and does face recognition all day long, matches faces to insurgents, records patterns of where people are at. It's sort of a mobile, you know, spy, but it also is sort of the eye of the law. So you know that if something bad is going down, then help will be on the way. And so in the book, people, for a long time, they spit on him every time he goes by. The kids put stickers on him. They spray paint him.
I love the kids putting stickers on him. So right on.
and you know, and they try to break him, and they try to trick, you know, the bad guys. They try to trick the SAP into hurting people, because that's where, you know, that it's really a, it's more of a moral game. You know, it's not so much about how many people you kill, it's about, you know, how it happens and where the trust is at. And so SAP is constantly being abused, but he's also constantly out there, you know, as a protector for people.
Well, I love the way description you have, reverse guerrilla warfare. That's so brilliant.
You know, you constantly hear about how the person who is an insurgent, you know, who's laying down an IED and then turns around and just blends into the society and is just, you know, the guy selling cell phones or something on the corner. And so, yeah, the reverse guerrilla warfare is that SAP is kind of a soldier, but he can't hurt anybody. And he wears the local clothes, memorizes faces, greets people, becomes part of the community. And, you know, it becomes part of this community. And that's something that they try to make soldiers do now, but it's very difficult. And you can't, you know, a grunt, from what I've heard, I interviewed lots of soldiers, a grunt will do anything you tell him to. And the problem, though, is that you can't just tell an army private to, you know, learn to speak another language and automatically know all the cultural nuances. So,
well, as you say in the book, that they'd much rather deal with a robot than a 19-year-old high on hormones in first-person shooter games.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're building a robot that interacts with people, civilians, then I think as a roboticist, your number one priority is to make that robot predictable. If the robot's internal state is very clearly telegraphed to everybody around them, then they'll be comfortable interacting with that machine. I mean, when you get scared of a robot is when it's got no face and it's got no body language and you don't know what it's thinking and you don't know if it's going to suddenly move and hurt you. You don't have any communication. And so once you have that, then you've got a robot that's, you know, going to be able to interact with real people.
Well, one of the things, too, you bring out in this is that fighting a robot isn't like fighting a human. It's not like a bar fight. It's like getting your hand stuck in the car door when somebody slams the door.
Yeah, all the fighting with the machines is very quick and violent, you know? I mean, I think we're used to seeing robots in movies and stuff, you know. Your most famous robot-human conflicts involve a lot of drama. Mm-hmm. And they are very similar to horror movies, you know? So, I mean, I love the Terminators, you know? Mm-hmm. But you'll see a Terminator where he'll, you know, Arnold will grab his prey, the person he's trying to kill, pick him up, and throw them really mm-hmm. far away. And then they'll bounce off the wall and they'll lay there. And then what Arnold will do is he will walk very slowly toward the person that's on the ground. And man, that is dramatic. That's your classic horror movie. That's, you know, Jason with the machete walking leisurely toward the, you know, the girl screaming and trying to run. But that's not really very true to a robotic character, you know. If a robot gets a hold of you and its goal is to kill you, it ain't going to throw you across the room. I mean, you're going to be done.
It will tear you in half.
If a Terminator got a hold of you, had one hand on your body, yeah, you'd be done. It would be like getting your hair cut in a piece of machinery, you know? It wouldn't be very fun to watch. but you know, I think that's the challenge, is to find other more accurate ways to get your drama.
Well, there's certainly a no shortage of drama in this book. And one of the things, too, that you do very well in terms of pacing is take us from one place to another, where the conflict is at different levels. And I'm reminded of the famous William Gibson quote, "The future has arrived, it's just not distributed evenly." And that's certainly true in this case.
Yeah, some people are in, you know, urban areas where they're surrounded by robots and it's very intense. And other people are, you know, in the middle of Afghanistan and they see one robot and it's kilometers away through binoculars, but they know that if they get on this robot's radar, that it's curtains, you know? And so then it's a very much a cat and mouse type of game. So, you know, and a lot other times it's just completely mental, you know, just a robot on a cell phone. I know where you are. I mean, so yeah, I had a lot of fun going, you know, different routes with that. And also, you just can't have one chapter after another where it's just super intense, physical, and violent. That just gets exhausting. And you know, I think a lot of it is also the relationships between the characters. You know, you have mothers and daughters, you have brothers, and people who really care about each other. And so, you know, you're worried about them. And of course, as the author, I want to take advantage of that and and manipulate you and you know, and make you scared for them and then make you think they're okay and then you know, kill them.
Well, one of the things I think that makes this book so good, and I'd like to just talk about this, is the prose itself. This seems to be very finely turned. You know when to tell a joke, but it does. There's just a level of quality, and it's hard to pin down, but I'd say that although this book is essentially nonstop thrills, it's not really written in the style of a thriller. I think it's more written it's a very character driven in that
thank
sense.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. I mean, this is my first adult novel. Mm-hmm. So I had a middle reader that came out earlier this year, actually, called A Boy and His Bot. Mm-hmm. But that was my first, you know, whack at a novel. But I think that part of the reason that it is laid out in the way you described is that this is told by a narrator who is describing what he's seeing. And he's collected a lot of evidence from this, essentially this black box that collected all this data, you know, on the war. And so a lot of it is pretty visual, and he's, you know, because he's describing what he sees.
Now, one of the things you do, too, is when you describe what the descriptions are really vivid. And I think what helps us, I have to say, is that you do a good job of mining our cultural visual vocabulary for robots and kind of recombining it to your own purposes so that when you describe something, it's generally some things we have never seen before, but we have enough reference that we can put it together really quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just hit on it. That was my main challenge for the whole book. I mean, there's a reason that I stuck to a very, I mean, Robopocalypse. I want the reader to know this is about a robot uprising because, you know what? That's already a part of the cultural consciousness. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what a robot uprising is. We've seen them before. And so by invoking that, I allow the reader to hit the ground running, you know, and then I tried, and I hope I succeeded at building unique, surprising situations that people have never seen, could never have guessed at, and have never experienced before in other robot uprising, other books and movies that have covered that.
Well, it is really a cultural thing, and one of the things this is also, I think. There's been the science fiction genre of late has had a lot of work that talks about the singularity. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly fits in that subgenre of fiction. And the singularity is this point in time when our machines become smart enough that they're smarter than us and able to redesign themselves. And after that point, we have no idea where history is going.
It's a feedback loop of getting smarter. Yeah.
And I think you do this really well, but you do it in a manner that is both that I would describe as surprisingly accessible, that you ground it so much that it's much more frightening and much more surprising than we would expect.
Well, yeah, you know, it starts out from a familiar place, mm-hmm. In terms of it starts out in the near future, but also it's familiar, you know, oh, a robot got really smart and decided to kill everybody. Mm-hmm. And as you continue through the book, you realize that it's actually more complex than that. And you know, that's really, for me, that's the heart of it. I mean, that's where I really wanted to make sure that this is Daniel, you know, Wilson. Like, I have read all of that stuff, and this is where I'm getting to be myself. And, you know, and so you realize that the big bad guy is named Arkos, you know, and you realize that he's not completely devoted to killing humans. He's also studying other living creatures, and he's not killing anything except people. And for some reason, he's also making people robot hybrids. And also, there's these other humanoid robots that are freeborn and are even teaming up with humans. And so the whole landscape gets much more complex. There's people that are becoming robots. There's robots that are acting like people. Then there's there's regular vanilla people that are teaming up with robots. You know, and you know, you start to realize that this is a really smart creature that has really complicated goals, and you're not totally clear what they are. But it's nothing as dry as plain as just kill all humans. Clearly, that's not the goal. By the end, I hope that becomes apparent.
No, the end is really is wonderful and surprising, and I think there's a tone in this that I would describe as elegiac. It gets back to this idea of nostalgia for, you know, here's a book that makes us appreciate where we're headed and makes us appreciate where we are even more. That, you know, we live in a society that has a lot of conveniences, and again, you make us think about not only where we are, where we're going, but also where we've been, and kind of like when you look back at, you know, the apocalypse that we might, you know, somebody from the year 1899 might think, you know, look at the world now and think the world has ended. It was gone because there's no prairies left, nothing's left. It's all, you know, we've destroyed the world.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a moving target, you know, mm-hmm. that we have. You know, I constantly, while putting my place in, putting myself into the place of my characters, would think to myself, oh, man, I'm glad I'm in this coffee shop. This is just terrible. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and you really do, as people undergo these horrible events, you really do appreciate where we're at right now. But, you know, I think that technology is always changing, and it's scary because it's always changing. And so, you know, we always have this fear that it's all going to go away and that, you know, we're going to be in trouble without it. So, you know, every generation has their own version of that.
Well, I'd like you to talk, too, about creating this novel, because it's very, very, the novel itself is a very, very complicated machine.
Yeah, well, you know, I laid out all these threads. I knew what my favorite scenes were.
Mm-hmm.
I had the advantage of you know, I wrote the first 100 pages, and those were just the cream of the, those are my favorite scenes possible. And I had accumulated these over the years, you know, because mm-hmm. I've been writing all of this nonfiction, but never really being able just to get creative and just completely explore and just make robots up, you know, and then make them behave and put them around people, you know, and have all this stuff really happen. And so I had just a huge list of just the most awesome events ever. Like, you know, the scene when the humans have captured these big walking robots and they've ripped the legs off and put them, attached them to tanks, and they call these things spider tanks, and they're walking through the prairie, you know. And
the spider tank scenes are great.
They're riding spider tanks, and the spider tanks, you know, one of them is getting swarmed with these little explosive devices, and it's jumping around, and it's basically like a rodeo, and there's literally a cowboy on top of a spider tank, and it's going nuts. I mean, that kind of stuff, I loved it, and I just wanted to have a way to say it. And then I wrote the 100 pages, and that was, you know, I think it was, I don't know how many chapters it was, but it was a lot of those ideas got out there. And that got such traction immediately that I just knew, oh boy, you know, it was, this book was really, it really came easy because it was really something I'd wanted to write for a long time, and everything in it I really loved. There was nothing, there's just no chapter that I don't like. Well, there's one chapter that my wife didn't like, but
well, I mean, and I think that sense of fun translates for the readers as well, even though it you know, threatens to be a tad on the depressing side since most of us die. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that is interesting in this book is readers kind of, as a reader, you tend to put yourself in this situation. Where am I in this book?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so one of the things you do is people are said, you know, there's a problem. All go here. Everybody go here, which and you have to wonder, would I be one of those people who went along?
Yeah. Would you just be a sheep or would you? Yeah. I mean, well, this is why it's fun. This is why horror movies are fun. You put yourself in that place and then you think about what's your escape plan? What's your, you know, your route? Yeah, my wife and I do that all the time. We have our own zombie, you know, escape plan that we discuss.
Well, not giving away too much, there are actually essentially zombies in this book as well.
Is that, can you believe that's never, that is maybe the coolest thing. And when I had that idea, which I won't reveal what it is, but it's horrific. And when I had that idea, I was in the shower and I just started punching the wall. I was like, that's the greatest thing ever. And then the question was, well, who's going to get it? You know? And then unfortunately, yeah, some people had to, some characters had to eat it. So. But, you know, I really, just on my own sort of note, I really think that the book's violent and a lot of bad things happen, but I think that it's really about a birth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is at the end of this book, you know, there are robots that are freeborn, that are sentient. They're thinking on their own, and they're humanoid, you know, and they're fighting alongside people and as equals. And so, you know, to me, that was kind of the most interesting part, is that we got from the beginning where we think of our technology as ours. We made it.
Mm-hmm.
It serves us. They're tools. And by the end, in order to survive,
it's our partner.
We're in a new place. And it's really the sort of the birth of a new society with two players that are on equal footing, not because they love each other or they respect each other or anything like that, but because they die without each other. And to me, I mean, I think that's the crux of it. You know, that's why we have civilization. It's because we depend on each other to survive.
Now, you're working on a new novel now too. That's not a sequel to this. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it's called Amp,
mm-hmm.
And that's meant to evoke, you know, amplify, amputate, ampere, and it's basically a story of a person that's living through sort of a near future human rights war, where people have basically neural implants have become affordable, and they make people smart. And other people have realized that once we start putting technology in our bodies, those people get an advantage, and then everybody's going to have to put technology in their bodies, and it's not going to be a choice because you're going to have it in order to compete. And so, you know, it's really about society acclimating to this idea of when our technology migrates under our skin. And right now, it's fine. Everybody, you know, you can go buy a new iPhone and it's fine. You know, kids these days, they totally ask you a question, why is the sky blue? And yeah, you're supposed to know the answer because if you don't have it in your head, you just look on your iPhone, you know, or your mobile device. But what about when that goes inside? You know, what about when you can't turn it off and when you can't, you know, decide to throw it away? Because we all flatter ourselves that we could, if we wanted, quit checking Facebook and, you know, take a week off. But, you know, I think there's this inflection point coming when, in order to get the full benefit of technology, it's gonna need to come into our bodies. And that's going to be a really traumatic time, I think, for society. And, you know, just to clarify, I think it's going to come through medical domains first. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be somebody who had epilepsy and then they have this and now they're okay. And they're also a little bit extra smart. So that's it.
That sounds like fun. Now, one of the things about this novel is it's very cinematic, and I understand it's been optioned for a movie. And so tell us a little bit about that. That must have been exciting to have that happen.
Oh, yeah, it was a little exciting. I was a little excited about that. So, you know, right when the novel was selling to Random House Doubleday, the DreamWorks, optioned the rights. And I went and met with everybody at DreamWorks and had just a great discussion about, you know, the novel and where it was going to go because I still needed to write the rest of it. And so while I was writing the novel, I was also interacting with the art department at Amblin. They were building.
Wow, they're already working on it then.
Yeah, they were creating images, you know, just concept art. And the screenwriter is writing it, or was writing it. He's finished.
Who's the screenwriter?
Drew Goddard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
wow.
So Drew has an amazing pedigree, and he's a really, really cool, approachable guy.
Mm-hmm.
So Drew started out writing Buffy the Vampire Slayer episodes for Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
Then he started writing Lost episodes for J.J. Abrams. And then he wrote Cloverfield. And now he's writing a movie for Spielberg, so I guess, you know.
that's pretty rockin'.
Yeah, right? I don't really know how you could have a better sort of path, you know, through your career. But, so Drew's writing it, and he's asking me questions about the plot, and, you know, and I'm realizing, oh, wow, you know, this is going to be vetted by these really incredibly talented people. The production designer's asking me, yeah, but what does the room really look like? Because I have to draw it. What's a Faraday cage look like? You know, stuff like that. And so it made me really focus in, you know, on the book, realizing that, you know, that these people were going to be looking at it. And of course, so Steven Spielberg officially announced that he's going to direct this, which that announcement came earlier this year. And I mean, that put me over the moon. So we'll, you know, right now, he's going to film Lincoln at mm-hmm. the end of this year. And hopefully Robopocalypse will be next, but we'll see.
In 2013, or assuming we get past 2012.
Well, based on everything I've seen so far, and I've gone down to visit another time since then and seen the artwork, and mm-hmm. it is just incredible. I mean, I wrote this book for me, and I feel like now I've got Spielberg making a movie just for the best movie ever. You know? So, you know, we'll see. But I'm a big fan of, obviously. And I love movies that other people have complaints about, too, that mm-hmm. Spielberg has made. So, you know, I know that personally, I don't have any qualms about it.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Now, I'm wondering, as a writer, so the development of the movie actually played a part in the completion of the novel then?
You know, they were keeping me honest about mm-hmm. what I was writing.
It sounds like,
of course, they can only choose a smaller subset of the book
mm-hmm.
To focus on. And I haven't read the screenplay or anything like that. I mean, that's Drew's thing, and he's a pro, and, you know, I know he's kicking butt.
Well, it sounds to me that the fact that it was even in that ballpark must have had some sharpening of focus for you as a writer?
Well, it lit a fire under my butt, you know, because they wanted these pages. And they'd talk to me and they'd say, well, you know, we really want to base this screenplay on your book, Daniel, but, you know, we're writing. I said, well, just hold on, guys. I'll get this to you. Takeo did something really cool this chapter. You're going to want to read it. So, you know, it sped me up. Yeah, it gave me extra focus. It's really a once-in-a-lifetime sort of situation to be writing a book in. And I love it, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tried to recreate it with AMP by selling those film rights. But, you know, Robopocalypse, I didn't set out to sell the film mm-hmm. rights. That was an accident because the pages, a scout in the publishing world, forwarded those pages to Los Angeles. And so, you know, that was never my intent. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I can't believe it because it doesn't make sense, but I really should have thought to myself while I was writing and scheming Robo, this, you know, think about the movie, but I never did. I was just writing a book.
Mm.
And so then it leaked and that happened. And it was really just a fortunate accident.
Well, it's truly a ripping yarn.
Thank you.
and also, as I say, it has a truly poignant moments in it. And that's what takes it an extra step. And that's why we look forward to AMP.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Daniel Wilson. His newest book is Robopocalypse. Thank you for joining me, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.